Hello and welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about The Gates Ajar by Elizabeth Stuart Phelps. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. Today our guest is Claudia Stokes, a professor of English at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. She's the author of several books, including The Altar at Home, Sentimental Literature and 19th Century American Religion, and most recently, Old Style, Unoriginality and Its Uses in 19th Century U.S. Literature. She also wrote the introduction to the Penguin Classics edition of The Gates Ajar. And I would be remiss not to say that Claudia and I were buddies as undergraduates at the University of Michigan many, many moons ago. She joins us by Skype as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station WRFH in Michigan. Claudia, welcome to the Great Books Podcast.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Why is The Gates Ajar by Elizabeth Stuart Phelps a great book?
I would say that it's greatly important. As I think you probably know, I tend to be pretty skeptical about terms like great books. But I think there's no question that it's Elizabeth Stuart Phelps's novel, The Gates Ajar, is greatly important. It isn't really remembered today, but its impact is really felt all around us without our perhaps realizing it. Elizabeth Stuart Phelps's novel is pretty much single-handedly responsible for shaping widespread American views of the afterlife. Today, Americans of all walks of life, from all faith traditions, generally presume that the afterlife or heaven will allow them to be reunited with people they love. We often conceive of the afterlife as a kind of great big family reunion where we are, again, reunited with people we've lost. That view is actually not in scripture. I mean, there are kind of hints, but that view is actually not in scripture, and it was not widely held really until 1868 when Elizabeth Stuart Phelps published The Gates Ajar, and in it she offers this really persuasive, really compelling view of the afterlife. And in the novel, various characters are just completely transfixed by this idea of the afterlife, are completely persuaded by it. And that ends up really forecasting how Americans would respond to the novel and would eventually receive this idea of the afterlife.
We're going to talk about all of that, the book, the story it tells, the characters, what it says about heaven and the afterlife, why it has gripped our imaginations so much since this book appeared, and more. But Claudia, I got to start with your latest book, a question about your latest book called Old Style. I love the subtitle.
Thank you.
Unoriginality and Its Uses in 19th Century U.S. Literature. I can't help but laugh. It's a counterintuitive idea that there is a kind of artistry that can be unoriginal, I suppose. But at any rate, tell us about unoriginality in 19th century literature and how it connects with this novel, The Gates Ajar.
Thank you for that. So I'm glad you like the title. So we have this really enduring belief that artistic greatness, that literary greatness are characterized by innovation, by experimentation, by novelty. But that is, I think we should remember, a fairly new idea. And it emerged really in the aftermath of World War I in the context of the aesthetic we call modernism. For example, famously, you know, the poet Ezra Pound said that the task for the poetry was, quote, to make it new. But again, that's a very modern 20th century idea. But the problem to my mind is that we use this modern idea to evaluate literature of the past, when writers and artists didn't necessarily aspire to newness. So what my book has tried to do is to peel back some of these modern 20th century expectations about literature. And instead, I try to recover that unoriginality was not only respectable, but really desirable, really through the 19th century. That today, we might think of unoriginality as the marker of lesser talent or of the hack. But in the 19th century, and really much earlier, I mean, this aesthetic that I'm describing is, frankly, like millennia old. But really, until very recently, writers and artists demonstrated their education, their training, their respectability, and their taste by situating themselves within clear precedents, by using very familiar techniques and tropes, by presenting themselves as extensions of literary tradition. That these features didn't disqualify them or didn't make them look bad, but instead these features, these qualities, unoriginality, often really helped writers demonstrate their deserving of public attention and readership.
And this idea is alive and well today with genre fiction mm-hmm. and movies right. that feel derivative and so forth.
I think so, but I think now we really expect movies and so forth to do something new. And I will say that in the 19th century, newness was regarded with a lot of skepticism and a lot of cynicism. And, you know, and there are some really innovative texts and writers in the 19th century who were regarded with great skepticism. And I think we might remember that, you know, Melville's Moby Dick, which is really an extraordinarily innovative novel, was received with a great deal of skepticism and head scratching. Critics and readers really had no idea what to make of it. And Melville was really questioned. You know, I think of other writers like Dickinson. I mean, she didn't publish a whole lot, but when she did, critics were very, just really thought that she had no education at all. And so, I mean, for sure, you're right that genre fiction probably, readers of genre fiction really expect these texts to honor convention. But for the most part, certainly in film, we expect films to do something new. But newness in the 19th century was not regarded as fundamentally good the way it is today.
So how does this connect with Elizabeth Stuart Phelps and The Gates Ajar? She publishes this in 1868, as you mentioned. Is it original, unoriginal, both? How would you rate it?
Yeah, I would say both. On the one hand, it very clearly fits within this august tradition of female-centered novels that we call sentimental. It's a kind of pejorative term, but it was a highly scripted, enormously popular literary tradition that was female-centered. And in many ways, The Gates Ajar is a very conventional sentimental novel. It has many of the tropes. It has a kind of orphan girl at its center. It depicts her maturation and her growing piety. These are all very traditional features of sentimental literature. But on the other hand, it really does do something new in that it offers us this completely new idea of the afterlife. And it depicts, you know, women's with great seriousness, it depicts women's religious authority, and it becomes kind of scriptural in its description, its vision of the afterlife as a kind of family reunion.
We're going to get into these questions of the afterlife in just a moment, but I want to start with the story and the characters. And the book opens with Mary Cabot grieving over the death of her brother Roy in the Civil War. Remember, it's an 1868 novel. This is a Civil War novel, or an immediately post-Civil War novel. But Mary is grieving over the death of her brother, Roy. How did he die, and why is her despair so deep?
I don't think we ever find out how he dies, specifically. So we just know that he dies in the war, that, you know, Mary gets the telegram, or she gets the letter notifying her that he has died. I think we just presume that he was shot and died. Really, when the novel opens, she has already received the letter notifying her that her brother has died, and she's completely despondent. And part of her grief is not only the loss of her close brother, but her grief is really worsened by some of the misguided comments of the people in her immediate religious community. A couple people come and visit her, and they make it clear to her. So I will mention that Mary seems to belong to a Calvinist religious community. And a number of the people who visit her suggest that they find her grief excessive and even sinful, that her grief suggests that she has not resigned herself to God's will. And a couple, and I think that the deacon who visits her questions whether her brother is in fact going to heaven. And that fills her with despair. But I think what really exacerbates her grief is the suggestion that even if her brother does go to heaven, he has likely forgotten her, that he is so absorbed by worship of the deity that he has forgotten his worldly life and thus has forgotten his loving relationship with his sister. And so as a result, Mary feels twice bereaved, that she has lost her brother in the worldly sense, and that he has, and if he goes on to the afterlife, that he has forgotten her even there.
The book takes the form of a series of diary entries from Mary. And I should say the book is pleasingly short.
You can read it.
It's not one of these mammoth, you know, Victorian era novels, but it takes the form of these diary entries. I think it's the second one where Mary refers to the most exquisite of inquisitions, the condolence system. And that's what you say, these disastrous visits from people who mean well, but make things worse.
So she receives a number of visits from two clerical figures, two ministerial figures, both the minister of her congregation, Dr. Bland, and the deacon, Aunt Deacon Quirk. And their visits are, you know, these visits are supposed to be comforting, but they really only aggravate her grief. They make it clear to her that her grief is unacceptable and maybe even excessive, that they expect her to have returned really to the kind of normal status quo. And their comments really question, they cause her to question the existence of the afterlife, and they cause her, they're so misguided that they cause her to cease to attend Sunday worship services. You know, that these visits are supposed to comfort her, but as a result, she ends up really becoming kind of an apostate. She abandons her religious community. She stops attending worship services, and she stops having any esteem for the afterlife at all. And then on the heels of these disastrous visits, she receives a letter from her long-lost Aunt Winifred, her deceased mother's sister, who is herself a widow. And her Aunt Winifred comes to visit her, and her aunt, who is, the wife of a deceased minister, attempts to console Mary, and she is much more successful at consoling Mary. And part of what she does is offer her a completely different view of the afterlife, a view of the afterlife that is utterly contrary to the views promoted by Calvinism, promoted by her minister, Dr. Bland. And she offers this vision of the afterlife as really an extension of our worldly lives. The afterlife includes the continuation of our worldly loving relationships. And she suggests that these relationships are not gone, but that our loved ones are attentive to us while we remain alive, and they're waiting for us when we die.
That sounds so familiar.
Yes.
As an idea of heaven, certainly here in the 21st century when we think about it, but it was revolutionary.
Yes, that's right. So I will say that Elizabeth Stuart Phelps was a highly educated elite woman from the Northeast, from New England. Her father, Austin Phelps, was himself an ordained minister. He was a professor at the Andover Theological Seminary. And so she was really very well versed in scripture. And I think that becomes clear in her writing of the novel. And so what the novel, the main, you know, this character, Winifred, doesn't invent this vision of the afterlife whole cloth, but it really is anchored in scripture, that Aunt Winifred takes these little bits and pieces from scripture and puts them together to offer this really new vision of the afterlife. So, for instance, you know, Aunt Winifred talks about these moments in scripture that mention like palms in the afterlife. And Winifred says, how can there be palms if there are no trees in the afterlife? And so she takes that to mean that there are forests, there are trees in the afterlife. And, you know, she's very resourceful as a reader and as a scholar of scripture. And she's able to take these little bits and pieces and use them to kind of flesh out, as it were, this new vision of the afterlife. And there's some really interesting scenes where we see Aunt Winifred kind of dueling with these ministers who have not been taught this vision of the afterlife, and they're just completely confounded by her arguments and her reasoning. So I think that, you know, this is a great book, as it were, not only for its really innovative vision of the afterlife, but also for its elevation of women's interpretive exegetical authority. You know, she suggests here that women can be really powerful, really inventive, but still really faithful religious leaders and interpreters of scripture.
So Claudia, Mary finds her comfort from Winifred, turns things around for her, and Winifred has an effect on the whole community.
She does, and in a way, Winifred's impact on the community, I think, really forecasts the impact that this book will have on American readers. That, you know, in the novel, we see all of these other people, various bereaved people who've lost loved ones, becoming increasingly attracted to Winifred's ministry, becoming increasingly attracted to this vision of the afterlife. And that really is what happens to American readers more generally in the aftermath of the publication of this novel. I mean, The Gates Ajar really spawned this whole cottage industry in the late 19th century. There were, Elizabeth Stuart Phelps published a number of sequels in which she tried to elaborate on this vision of the afterlife. There are lots of, you know, there are lots of spin-off novels. I will say that Mark Twain published a kind of spoof of The Gates Ajar. But The Gates Ajar also prompted all of these different brand names. So, for instance, there was a Gates Ajar brand of cigars published in the aftermath of this novel. There is still, evidently, a Gates Ajar funerary floral arrangement that, you know, again, was named after Elizabeth Stuart Phelps's novel, but evidently still exists today in the funerary floral industry. There were there were several really famous hymns named for this novel. There's a hymn tune called The Gates Ajar that is still in circulation. It just became a brand in the aftermath of the novel's publication in the late 19th century.
So this book was massively successful in its time. It changed the way we think about heaven. These are huge claims. Mm-hmm. How come we haven't heard more about this book?
That's a great question. So I think partially it's because, you know, Phelps's ideas became so mainstream that it's hard for us to recognize this novel as the source of these ideas. You know, it was so influential that it just seems like it's arguing facts. It's hard for us to see the novel in context. But I think the novel's disappearance from popular memory. I mean, I will say that it hasn't disappeared from, you know, the memory of scholars who study 19th century literature, who study religious literature, who study women writers. You know, this novel has remained a kind of canonical fixture. But as you say, it has receded from popular memory, I think because so much of the founding of English literary studies in the early 20th century meant the elevation of certain kinds of books and the dismissal of others. And so this often means that, well, this really meant that so many enormously popular and influential women writers of the past were just dismissed out of hand. They didn't make it into the canon of the 20th century. And in part, it's because they were women writers who wrote about female experience and who often wrote for female readers. And so many academic male scholars in the 20th century simply dismissed these things out of hand as trivial, as insignificant, as irrelevant. And as a result, you know, like over the last couple of decades, we've seen some really important recovery efforts to kind of retrieve and recover so many of these influential but forgotten women writers. And so I think the bottom line is that it was forgotten because of its female orientation.
Nathaniel Hawthorne once referred to the, quote, damned mob of scribbling women unquote. And I was reminded of that line because it's in the introduction that you wrote with your co-author to the Penguin Classics edition of The Gates Ajar. There were, of course, other women writers who are familiar today working in this time. Harry Beecher Stowe with Uncle Tom's Cabin. You know, my goodness, there's a novel that is well remembered, maybe more remembered than Red in a certain sense. So that one's coming back too, isn't it? Little Women by Louisa May Alcott. Are these all sentimental novels about female experience? And this is just another one of those in that genre. And what does that mean? You've discussed it a little bit, but tell us what does sentimental mean? Why that word?
Right. You're absolutely right. That all of these novels, that Elizabeth Stuart Phelps, that Harry Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, that Alcott's Little Women are all absolutely right, are categorized as sentimental novels. So the term sentimental, these writers did not identify themselves as sentimentalists. That was a term that was really given to them later by these 20th century academic critics who gave them the term sentimentalism basically as a way of dismissing them, as dismissing these writers as overly emotional, as kind of soggy, you know, as weepy, and thus not to be as manipulative and thus not to be taken seriously. I'll spare you the kind of prolonged history of sentimentalism as a movement, but I just want to clarify that sentimentalism really lasts throughout the entirety of the 19th century. There are some really important scholars like Lauren Berlant, who have shown how sentimentalism really endures through the 20th century and into today. But the bottom line is that sentimentalism was a female-centered literary movement of the 19th century. It includes not just novels, but also poems. It includes lots of other genres. But these novels narrate typically the developmental stories of female maturation and adolescence. So typically, sentimental texts have as their main characters young women who are often orphans, whose parents are gone or away. They've been separated from their families, and thus they are in some ways really serious danger. And so what typically happens in sentimental literature is we see the emergence of these alternate family units of kindly adults who emerge to fill the void left by these girls' parents, and they create a kind of consenting family, and they often this entails religious education and religious instruction, and these novels typically narrate, the young girls or the young woman's development and maturation and her preparation for adulthood and typically her preparation for marriage and the assumption of adult responsibilities. And so I think just from that description, you might be able to hear some ways in which this is The Gates Ajar is very much a sentimental novel in that, you know, Mary Cabot, when the novel begins, her parents have died, her brother has died. When the novel begins, she's all alone in the wide, wide world, to evoke the title of Susan Warner's best-selling sentimental novel, The Wide, Wide World. And this aunt, Winifred, emerges to take the role of a kind of steward or guardian. And she offers her religious instruction. And over the course of the novel, you know, Mary matures and she grows and she heals and she's willing to assume her adult responsibilities by the close of the novel.
To what extent is this a war novel? And it's obviously not a war novel the way The Red Badge of Courage by Stephen Crane or The Killer Angels by Michael Schar are war novels, mm-hmm. which is, you know, actual combat scenes and so forth. But this is about the home front.
That's right.
And you know, the war, more than 600,000 soldiers died during the Civil War, and all of them came from somewhere. Is that a good way to think about this book as a war novel?
Yes, that's absolutely right. And so I just want to mention that this is one of the reasons why I was able to collaborate with my wonderful co-editor, Elizabeth Duquette, who has really conducted so much important research on the American Civil War. And so because I've worked on sentimentalism, she's worked on Elizabeth Stuart Phelps. I just want to mention that my co-editor, Elizabeth Duquette, has also edited a collection of Phelps's short writings, short stories and poems and essays. But my co-editor has written extensively about the American Civil War. And so that's one of the reasons why we were able to work together so well. But you're exactly right. And really, Phelps wrote this novel in part because she was so dismayed by the suffering of women at the home front during the American Civil War. Phelps really felt that organized religion, especially Calvinist denominations, had really failed to comfort and to console these women who were aggrieved, and as you say, aggrieved on this mass, really unprecedented scale in American history. And so this is very much about the suffering on the home front and the ways in which women, because of the faults of traditional religious leadership, really are required to minister to each other. So you're exactly right. This is about the sufferings of women on the home front.
Now, how does this connect with 19th century spiritualism? Because I'm thinking, Mary, you're going to meet Roy in heaven. That's real comforting. That's a nice thought. And I think we all, at a certain level, hope that's true about the afterlife. But this book comes at a time when people are having new and different ideas about faith and the supernatural and so forth. Is this a spiritual novel? Is it a Christian novel? Help us understand all that.
Yeah, thank you for that. I feel like you just threw one right in my strike zone. So, there's some debate about this, but this is a hill I'm willing to, I don't want to say die on, but maybe have a headache on. So spiritualism was, as you mentioned, a really popular movement in, I would say, maybe the second half of the 19th century, well into the 20th century. And it's a movement that is interested in the supernatural. I would put it that way. Interested in the supernatural. It often entails like seances, a number of people who identify as media, and we would say medium, but the plural is media, become enormously popular. We see in this period some really interesting efforts to prove the existence of the supernatural. We see the development of like scientific institutes and programs in an effort to prove the existence of the supernatural. I and my co-editor, Elizabeth Duquette, we believe very strongly that this is not a spiritualist novel. I think the misconception of The Gates Ajar as a spiritualist novel comes from a title, decades ago, the only other edition that The Gates Ajar is available in is in an omnibus edition called Three Spiritualist Novels that collects both The Gates Ajar and Phelps's other sequels. And so I think the title of that omnibus collection, Three Spiritualist Novels, has really led to the widespread academic perception of this novel as spiritualist. But Phelps herself disavowed being a spiritualist. She claimed she was not a spiritualist. She was not interested in spiritualism. She disavowed any association with spiritualism. And I take that very seriously. As you say, you might expect Mary to be reunited with Roy, but she's not. Nobody conducts seances here. There's never any sense that Roy is a ghost. There's never any sense of the workings of the supernatural other than the deity. So I maintain that this is not a spiritualist novel. It's a Christian novel.
Does the book instruct us in how to deal with grief? If you're grieving yourself, can you read this book and have it provide consolation?
I think you can. I think that there are a number of lessons here for all of us as we experience bereavement. I think one of the lessons here is certainly for, those of us who visit the bereaved, that we should be very, very careful about the words that we use when we speak to people who are bereaved. We should not be careless. We should not make claims, that we should simply offer our understanding and our sympathy. But I think another lesson here is about the importance of community for those of us who are bereaved. When the novel begins, Mary is isolated. She has isolated herself. She is, I think we might recognize, she's clearly suffering from depression, and she's isolated herself. And her isolation is really only worsening her suffering. And one of the things I think that her Aunt Winifred not only brings her kind of religious teachings, but she also brings her social activity. She brings her community. And there's a real sense here in the novel that all of us will experience bereavement in our lives. There's no escaping grief. There's no escaping suffering. And the novel really invites us to find consolation and fellowship with each other. That when our parents die, our loved ones die, that it's really important for us to find fellowship and community with the loved ones who are still here. So I think one of the lessons of this novel is the importance of continuing to find pleasure and meaning in our existing social relationships. I also think that one of the lessons of this novel is the importance of finding hope in some form of the future, some vision of the future. I don't know that it necessarily has to be the afterlife, but the novel really shows us how healing and how important it is to have some anticipation for the future, whether it's the afterlife or whether it's some kind of looming event. But the novel seems to, you know, it tells us that we've got to look to the future in some kind of a hopeful way.
One more question as we wrap up, maybe a two-part question. Claudia, I know that this was on no syllabus you and I saw in Ann Arbor when we were undergraduates. How did you discover this book and this author? And then finally, what is the case for reading it right now?
So how did I find this? As you've mentioned, my research area is 19th century American literature. And for those of us who were in the field, I mean, this is really canonical. This is a really canonical book. And as you've mentioned, it's relevant in lots of different ways. You know, it's an important book just because it was a huge bestseller in the 19th century. It's also important because it's, you know, for anybody who studies, say, the Civil War, it's an important book. For anybody who studies, like, religious literature, it's an important book. For people who study women writers, it's an important book. So I don't even know how I first encountered this thing, because it's just, you know, it's a canonical book in so many different subject areas in the study of American literature. And I remember, you know, as a graduate student, before I'd even read The Gates Ajar, as a graduate student, just reading all of these canonical studies of the period, like, you know, Anne Douglas's book, The Feminization of American Culture, I remember just seeing it cited and discussed just about everywhere. So I think just as part of my training 100 years ago as a graduate student, I encountered The Gates Ajar. And to your second question, like, what is the value of reading it today? I think it's just a really important book. I also think, what is the value? It's an important book in American religious history. I also think it's an important book because it's about reading in a way. You know, the book is very much about the knowledge that we can glean from reading. I mean, in a way, you know, the book really offers a very compelling justification for the life lessons and the wisdom we can glean from reading. You know, there's a lot of debate, discussion today about, like, the value of a humanities education, of a liberal arts education. This book, I mean, there's lots to be said about the importance and the value of a liberal arts education, of a literature education, and these things have direct applications to the workplace and job skills and so on. But this book really communicates that we not only, you know, in reading and studying text, we not only get really valuable professional skills, but we can also acquire critical thinking skills, and we can also acquire just basic wisdom about the meaning of life, about the things that make our life valuable and meaningful.
Claudia Stokes, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about The Gates Ajar by Elizabeth Stuart Phelps.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You've just listened to the Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to the Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps to keep this podcast going. Please send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through my website at heymiller.com on Twitter. My handle is @heymiller. Last of all, special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of the Great Books Podcast.